Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's still snow on the ground in many parts of Vermont, but it's the official opening day of the 2018 baseball season. Both the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees were busy in the offseason in an effort to strengthen their teams. Will these moves be successful? And there's a big effort by Major League Baseball to speed up the game. There's some wild proposals that are being tried out at the minor league level, proposals that have some baseball purists just screaming in agony. Is baseball at a key tipping point? What's the outlook for this season? These are some of the questions we have today for our all-star panel. Three people who truly love the game of baseball. With us, VPR's Amy Noyes. Amy is a big Red Sox fan. Also, Burlington representative Kurt Wright, who is a diehard Yankee fan. And VPR's Mitch Wortlieb, who has an amazing passion for sports, baseball, and the Boston Red Sox. I'd like to welcome you all back. It's great to be in springtime and the start of the baseball season. Play
Thanks
ball.
Thanks for having us here, Bob. Love it.
Well, as we know, neither the Red Sox or the Yankees made it to the World Series last year. Both teams had a busy offseason. Both teams also have new managers. Amy, what are your thoughts about this 2018 Red Sox team? Are you feeling good about this group of players?
I am. There's not a huge change for the Sox. I think we might see some pitching changes come. I'm very excited to have Brock Holt back. I am always excited about our outfield, and now that we have J.D. Martinez on the team, that can't hurt. So I'm upbeat.
How about the pitching? Do you feel good about the pitching staff?
Well, we're starting out with three guys on the 10-day DL. So we're kind of in a holding pattern with some pitchers. Two brand new pitchers coming up, Workman going down. So there's a lot of question marks there. And we have Price back as a starter. So I'm going to hold off and see what happens.
You sound pretty optimistic.
Fairly optimistic.
All right. We did get this email from Andrew who wrote us, "Everyone's talking about the fearsome Yankees being the team to beat. I do not understand why. The Red Sox have the same team they won the division with last year. They've added pieces, included a power hitter. Seems like the Sox are the team to beat in the AL East. I predict the Yankees will win a lot of games by scoring a lot of runs. They're going to lose a lot with poor defense, suspect pitching, and tons of strikeouts. They will finish behind the Red Sox again," says Andrew. All right, Kurt, what about Andrew's analysis?
Well, it's a good point in that they did win the division last year, and they did win. Nobody should be feeling sorry for the Boston Red Sox, who now have, by the way, the number one payroll in baseball.
I knew that was
number
coming.
Seven, as reported in the Daily News today. Yankees are down to their lowest payroll since 2003. But the reality is the Yankees are sort of – there's been some changes. The times they are changing for the Yankees, but in some ways they're getting back to the old ways in that when the core four retired, the Yankees sort of lost their identity. Their offense was really down. They sort of had become in some ways a little boring, even though I continue to love them. But starting at the end of the 2016 season, things began to get interesting again with the young players coming up, Sanchez and others. And last year, it became extremely interesting. And so while Bob says neither team made the World Series, that's true. Yankees came within one game of making the World Series as a big, overachieving team last year. Aaron Judge became one of the faces of baseball. Last year at this time, he was fighting to make the team and become the right fielder. As the season went on, he became the face of baseball, as reported. So this year, they picked up the National League MVP, and obviously that's why a team that overachieved with Judge and Sanchez and Severino, et cetera, now has the National League MVP on the team. But we're going to have to see. That a lot of times when guys change leagues, they have a period where they don't do so well. And will Judge suffer a sophomore jinx? I mean, can he replicate what he did last year? Or will there be a sophomore jinx? The Yankees are hoping that he's healthy all year and actually could be better. I don't know if he could be better than 52 homers, but last year he had an August where he didn't miss time, but he played with a sore shoulder and he hit 185 in August. So the pitching staff is actually back and it's not that bad. And the bullpen actually is going to be probably the best and deepest in baseball. And I think that's why people are excited. But it's going to the rivalry is going to be more intense than ever actually this year, I think. And I as excited as I was to start the season last year, I'm even more excited this year. We have one injury, though, to start the season out already. Greg Bird, who the problem with him is he's becoming injury-prone player, is going to miss the first 6 to 8 weeks of the season.
You know, Kurt, the combination of Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton has some old fans thinking about Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle. And I saw this very interesting statistic. You know, this is what I love about baseball. You have all these statistics that are out there. But this one, I think, applies pretty well. And it's the all-time record in the course of a season that players on a team have hit back-to-back home runs. Now, I would have thought with Mantle and Maris going back-to-back, oh, gee, it must have happened 25 or 30 times during the 1961 season. But it turns out the record is 19, and it was set by the Seattle Mariners in 1996. Do you think that record is going to be threatened this year?
That's an odd statistic that you point out, Bob, an interesting one. I think certainly it could be challenged this year with the Yankees having Stanton and Judge batting back-to-back a lot and also Sanchez in there, Stanton, Judge, and then Sanchez mixed in. The Yankees are going to be a team to watch no matter what happens because of the fact that they have these twin towers, as they're calling them, Stanton and Judge, who are going to hit not only home runs but some of the longest home runs in baseball. They did it last year. You're going to see these 450-foot bombs where people are oohing and aahing, and I think it's going to mean Yankee attendance, which is pretty good anyway, is going to go up, and the ticket's going to be that much harder to get and more expensive to get. But it's going to make for an interesting show if people stay healthy and they do what is anticipated.
So, Mitch, what are your thoughts about this 2018 Boston Red Sox team? You feeling pretty good?
Yeah, before I get to that, Bob, I just want to note that it took all of 2 minutes into the show for Kurt Wright to mention that the Red Sox had the highest payroll in baseball, which, of course, just had me rolling my eyes here. Let's just
true, though.
Can we just absolutely true, but can we all just agree that if you're a fan of the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Cubs, or the Cardinals, you have absolutely no right to talk about payroll. They're all big spending teams. If you're a fan of the Royals or the San Diego Padres or the Minnesota Twins, then you can gripe at me about payroll. But Bob, to your question, I am very optimistic about this Red Sox team this year. I really like what Andrew said, who sent that email before, who said that he thinks the Red Sox are going to finish ahead of the Yankees in the division. I like what Amy had to say about welcoming back this team that's very much like last year's, but with a little more pop. With all that said, as optimistic as I am about the Red Sox, I cannot see them beating the Yankees this year. I can't see anyone doing it for all the reasons that Kurt just pointed out. The middle of that lineup, this is going to be a modern-day 21st century version of Murderer's Row. It's not just Judge and Stanton, which is bad enough, but Sanchez is one of the most remarkable home run hitters in the game. They still have other guys up and down the line. Didi Gregorius is only getting better and showing more power every year. This team is going to be so deep that even if their pitching doesn't do that well, and I think they are a pretty good staff, they're going to be putting up 8-10 runs a game. They're going to be beating teams 12-10, 14-11. I'm not looking forward to that. I hope I'm wrong. As for the Red Sox themselves, I see a big bounce-back year coming for Xander Bogaerts, and he really needs one. He's a tremendous shortstop with power and all the tools you need. He was never quite the same last year after getting hit on the hand. Once he got hit on that hand, you saw the power drop off. He was changing his swing. He probably should have gone on the DL, and he didn't, and he suffered as a result. I expect a big bounce-back year from him. Mookie Betts, still one of the finest young players in baseball, is in that lineup. Andrew Benintendi, Jackie Bradley Jr. in the outfield. If he can bat around 270, his defense more than makes up for any shortcomings in his offensive game. Christian Vasquez could have a breakout year as a catcher. Blake Swihart could be a huge X factor for the Red Sox this year. He's a guy who got hurt multiple times, but he's one of these rarities in that he's a catcher with speed, and he can also play the outfield, first base. He's very versatile. So the Red Sox really
switch
do
hitter.
And a switch hitter, absolutely. I mean, you know, the Red Sox really do have the same team that did win the division last year, did go pretty far, you know, probably got beat by a better team in Houston. And with J.D. Martinez in the middle of that lineup, adding some power, which they desperately needed, they'll be better. The thing with Martinez, though, which I caution people, Tim Kirchen of ESPN pointed this out, that most of his power is to right and right center field. And that's where baseballs go to die at Fenway Park. He's going to play 81 games in Fenway. I'm really hoping that he doesn't try to alter his swing too much to compensate for that. If he can deal with those things, though, and he can put up the power numbers, the Red Sox will certainly be better.
So, Mitch, some of our listeners know that both the Red Sox and the Yankees have new managers this year. How much difference can a manager make in the performance of a team?
That's a great question, and it's one that I really struggle with because I look at a team, again, like the Yankees, and I really think that me or Kurt or Amy, maybe even you, Bob, could actually manage the Yankees and roll out that lineup and just win, and we'd be called geniuses. On the other hand, I really am looking forward to Alex Cora. I do think that there is something to a young guy like Cora is. He's one of the youngest managers in the league. In fact, he used to play with Dustin Pedroia. They were on the same team together on the field. He relates well to the younger players. I think you need that in today's game. He's fluent in Spanish. He can relate well to the Hispanic players on the team. And I really think that he's shown the right attitude. He's going to bring a lot of energy. I think it's a good move. I don't know how many games it's going to actually win you. We're going to find out. You never really know. But I do think it's a positive development to have Cora brought on for the Red Sox.
Today on the program, it's our annual baseball show. Today is opening day for the 2018 baseball season. Let's start with Bob in Rutland. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Bob. Quick opinion, comment first is, on the last two major league games I went to, a lot of people were standing even while the game was going on, you know, during the innings, just socializing. It's become like a social event. And people don't, you know, they get into this event and then they're ready to move on to the next one. So I think they're trying to speed through the game just to get to their next event. Well, my question is for your guests is, recently there was the Save America's Pastime Act that was passed, which means minor league baseball facilities no longer have to have the minimum wage law applied to them. So I don't know what their opinion was of that. Thank you.
All right, Bob, thanks very much. Actually, two big changes for baseball in that tax bill. But as Bob mentioned, the new law exempts baseball from having to pay overtime. So the way they calculate a minor league salary is to say, well, you're working 40 hours, you're making $7.25 an hour. That works out to about $1,000 a month. And this is in contrast, Kurt, you know, so here's a minor league player, maybe somebody playing in Burlington this year with the Lake Monsters, making perhaps $1,000 a month. And then I looked at what it would be for someone making $30 million a year at the major league level. Well, that works out to be about $200,000 a game. Is this a problem for baseball?
Well, I mean, obviously we know that when we think of baseball players, we think how much money they make. But, of course, that's the percentage of players that make it to the big leagues, and they're going to do very well no matter if they're making the minimum major league salary or not. But in the minor leagues, of course, as you correctly know, they are not making that kind of salary. They're at that point, they're doing it for the love of the game, and they are hoping they can make the major leagues, but most of them will never make it. And they are making a small salary. So anything I think that actually keeps their salaries down is not a good thing. It's not fair to them. So I think that is a concern.
And Mitch, the other part of the tax law that applies involves the capital gains tax. And probably the best example of this is Justin Verlander, who was traded from the Tigers to the Astros at the end of last season. Now, they look at Verlander and his $28 million salary. He got traded for three minor league players who had a combined salary of $20,000. So what the tax law is saying is that the Astros have to pay the difference, or a little over $27,980,000 in capital gains. What do you think that's going to affect?
I think it's going to affect the way teams look at trades and deals, just like the Verlander one. I was shocked to find out that that was something new in Major League Baseball. And you don't really think of the capital gains tax affecting things like Major League Baseball. But I do think that it's going to make owners think twice about trading for a player or, you know, accepting a trade for a player like that. And I do think it's going to, you know, maybe scuttle some deals that would otherwise be made. And I don't think that's very good for baseball. I think one of the fun things about the game, and the reason that we often do a show here on Vermont Edition halfway through the season around the All-Star break, is to look at what's coming up with the trades and see how teams can change radically by picking up a guy like Verlander, who was enormous for the Astros last year. I mean, I think they'd say he was worth every penny. At the same time, I don't think that's very good for baseball. And I think to the other point about the minor league salaries, you're going to lose a lot of potential stars in the game who are just not going to be able to make it because they're not going to be able to survive on that kind of a living, hoping that a team recognizes their talent one day. I don't think it's good for baseball.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today is Vermont Edition's annual baseball show, the opening day of the 2018 baseball season. We got this post from Ray, who says, I do not like the notion of starting extra innings with a runner on second base one bit. A lot of the other changes don't seem overly dramatic. There's no clock in baseball, but there does seem to be places that time could be shaved off of the duration of a game. Perhaps that would be a number of trips to the mound, changing the rules on intentional walks. But let's get back to this idea. If the game goes into the 10th inning, and this is going to be tried out at the minor league level, Amy, each team starts off with a runner on second. Good idea?
Terrible idea. I'm with Ray, 100%. I think that baseball does have a pace of play issue, but that's different than a marathon game issue. I think those marathon overtime games are part of baseball's charm, and sometimes I look forward to them.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, what do you think?
Absolutely outrageous, awful idea, one of the worst things I've heard. That is, you know, I know that, and that what's concerning me is the fact that they are trying it in the minor leagues, which concerns me that if they're trying it in the minor leagues, they may consider trying it in the major leagues. And that is, I can't say how bad an idea I think that is. I first heard that broached last year by Joe Torre, who I love. But come on, Joe, that is just a horrible idea. There is a danger that with these changes, they really will wreck the game of baseball that we all love. I think there does need to be some changes that are okay, like limiting the times that you can go out to a visit at the mound. They do need to sort of make some changes where there's this dead space in baseball, because for me, it's okay. But we know that young fans right now are looking for faster movement, and baseball's a slow-moving game, and the instant replays have made it even slower. And so they're trying to change, speed up the reviews, which is a good thing. You don't want those things dragging out. And the other change that I do support is limiting the times you can go to the mound. They're limiting it to 6 a game and an additional one if you go into extra innings per inning. I think that's good. Right now, for example, with the Yankees, our catcher Sanchez goes out to the mound more than any catcher in baseball, constantly, over and over and over. And that's not good. That is not a good thing to have the game slow down that to that degree. So I do think there are ways that you can eliminate some of the dead time. But the idea of starting an extra inning with a runner at second base, forget that. Throw that in the ash heap of history.
It's amazing to me it's even gotten this far that they're going to actually try it in the minor leagues. Is nobody thinking about the fact that with the starting a runner on second base, every single team, the first thing you're going to do is send the next guy up to bunt him over to third and try to get him in on a sack fly? I mean, you can't get anything more predictable and boring than that. I just can't believe that they've actually come up with this idea and that they're actually going to try it. This is like New Coke. This is like the Edsel. This is some of the worst marketing I've ever heard of.
All right. Now, Mitch, you're a big hockey fan.
Yeah.
What do you think about the shootout in hockey? Do you like that?
I'm not a huge fan of the shootout in regular season games. None of that bothers me, though, Bob, because when it comes to playoff time, there's no such thing as a shootout. And then one of the reasons I love hockey so much is there is nothing quite exciting, and I include baseball in this, there is nothing more exciting than a Game 7 hockey overtime playoff game. You don't have a shootout to decide it. The games can go on all night. They can go on for four or five periods, and someone's going to make a mistake, and they're the closest calls. So regular season deciding games by shootout, it's kind of fun to watch some of the moves, the breakaway stuff that they do. It's not the most ideal way to end a game, but it's probably better than a tie. As long as they don't do it in playoffs, I'm okay with it.
So I'm going to go a little left field on you here. But in recent years, the NHL went 3-on-3 for the first overtime period in order to cut down on the shootouts. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I was thinking I would rather see baseball make a move like that than start a guy on second. I would rather see the 10th inning with maybe no shortstop than start out with the guy on second. Honestly,
that's a bold idea, Amy. But honestly, why mess with something that doesn't need to be messed with?
Please don't do that. Don't do that. Don't listen to Amy on that baseball. You didn't. I hope you're not listening. No, that's a bad idea. Also, we don't need the radical changes. Small changes. I mean, again, the beauty of baseball, as was said, is that we don't have a clock in baseball. Football is a fast-moving game, but the one thing is the clock is there, and the game can, and so can in other sports, end because time runs out. And in baseball, as long as you keep getting base hit after base hit, the clock is not going to kill you, and we don't want that in baseball. We don't want no radical changes. Little changes that we're talking about that can improve the game and sort of end some of the dead time, that's fine. And for me, the game should stay the way it is, but I understand that we need to appeal to the younger generation. So I'm open to some small changes, but some of these other changes that baseball and Amy are talking about.
Don't blame it
on
Amy. Only in my mind.
Bob, I have to quickly say, I know we're not supposed to talk about other sports on the baseball show, but I do have to disagree with our Yankee fan representative here, Kurt, in that football is not a fast-moving game. Football
is the
most boring, slow-moving game that there is.
Well, when the action's going on, it is
the action, there's only about 11 minutes of sustained action in actual football.
I understand
football.
What you're
You run a play,
hey,
you walk back to the huddle. Let's talk baseball.
I don't know that everybody would agree with you on that.
Well,
so, Mitch, let me ask you this. You know what drives some people crazy when they watch a baseball game is, let's say they're watching David Ortiz, who used to play for the Red Sox.
I miss him so much.
And after every pitch, he would step out of the batter's box. I can almost see the image right now.
Fix the gloves.
He fixes the gloves. He spits into one glove. He claps his hands together. He gets back in the batter's box.
Yeah.
That goes on forever.
Mm. Pedroia does it too.
Yeah, and remember Nomar Garciaparra with his kind of like people used to look at it as like an OCD thing where he was just, you know, flap the gloves back and forth, tap the toes a few times, get back in the box. So you're asking me, Bob, is this a problem? Is that the question?
That is the question.
Not when Big Poppy does it. the guy who's batting 230 and is going to hit a dribbler to shortstop and he goes through all that, that's a problem. No, I kind of agree with Kurt on this one in that little changes are fine to change the game. But one of the things I have a problem with is when they talk about speeding up the pitcher or keeping the batter in the batter's box. And baseball's a hard enough game. It's, as Ted Williams famously said, the hardest thing in the world to do is to hit a round ball with a square bat. It's such a particular skill. And if these guys need a little routine that takes them 20 seconds or so before getting back in the box and it's going to help them be successful, I'm actually okay with that. It can be a little annoying at times, but I wouldn't want the player's performance to suffer because the umpire is saying, hey, get back in here. You got to go.
Let's go back to our callers and start off with John, who is calling from Richmond. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi there.
This is a little bit of an anecdotal history thing, but back in 1984, I was a bank teller in a Chittenden bank office, little office on Church Street in Burlington. In 1984, the Vermont Reds were playing. And members of that team used to come in and cash their paychecks. And if I remember correctly, guys like Barry Larkin, Chris Sabo, Rob Dibble were making about $400 a week in 1984. So you mentioned that thing about the minor league pay. If they go that direction, you're cutting the pipeline off at the source. Hmm. It's ridiculous.
All right, John, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's talk to Peter, who's calling from Worcester. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind today?
I'd like to know what your panel thinks the impact of Stephen Wright when he's on the DL now, and then he has a suspension. Mm-hmm. But when he comes back into the Red Sox rotation as a knuckleballer, what impact that has, there aren't that many knuckleballers now, and just having him in the rotation.
Mitch, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's a really good question. Stephen Wright is it's a troubling thing for me. I was a big fan of his before a lot of the news came out about, you know, he was arrested on a domestic violence charge. That's what the 15-game suspension is about. He says he never physically touched his wife, but, you know, there are some troubling things there. To the point about his effect in the rotation, Stephen Wright was really having a tremendous season a couple of years ago, and then he went on the DL because John Farrell, the then manager, made the inexcusable decision to put him in as a pinch runner, and I've never forgiven Farrell for this. I've heard other Boston scribes say, no, there was a good reason for it. It's nonsense. He ended up wrenching his shoulder, diving back to second base because he doesn't know how to run the bases. It was a stupid idea to put him in there, and he's never been the same since. Then he had a knee problem, which put him on the DL. And, you know, unless you're Tim Wakefield or certain other very few examples of knuckleballers that have had success in the big leagues over a sustained period of time, it seems like knuckleballers can have a very good season, maybe two, but over a consistency period, over a long period of time, they can't really get the job done. And for me, it's more troubling with Stephen Wright because I have a hard time, you know, getting behind him and rooting for him, knowing what I know now about what he may have done in that domestic situation. And that's it's a very troubling thing for me. I'm looking at other guys this season. I'm hoping that a guy like Brian Johnson, who's going to start the year because of the other DL situations, who's really gone through some very tough times. He's been hit twice by line drives that have put him on the DL, and he's dealt with anxiety issues, which he's been very forthcoming about, and some mental health issues, and the Red Sox have been very supportive of him. I'd rather see a guy like Brian Johnson have success and come in and be a difference maker for the Red Sox this year.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Frank in Essex. Hey, Frank, welcome to the program.
Thanks. How's it going?
Great.
So I was just calling, you had mentioned it a little bit earlier, the amount of time that's spent in the batter's box waiting for the next pitch, and I don't know if there's been proposals about whether a batter can step out of the box or how many pitches a pitcher can wave off before he has to pitch the ball. I'd be in favor of just eliminating signs, you know, from the catcher to the pitcher for with the next pitch. Just get it done. But I'll listen to your comments.
All right. Amy, what do you think?
Well, signs have been a problem. I think, it brings to mind the pitch clock, which I don't think is a good idea. I do think that some pitchers need to speed up their game. I love watching a Chris Sale game because it's a great pace. I don't think that you can cut off all communication between your pitcher and your catcher, but I do think cutting back on the mound visits is a good idea.
I agree. I mean, I do not think you can tell the pitcher not to the catcher to be given signals to the you know, back and forth which pitch they're going to pitch. That's got to stay. But again, I think that the proposals that they are talking about, the small proposals to decrease the dead time in baseball is fine. You know, last year they did the four pitch walk. Well, they don't do the pitches. They just put up four fingers in the. That was a little weird, but I can live with that. That's a change I can live with. I mean, again, for me, I wouldn't have made the change, but it's something I can live with, and I think some of these small changes are okay. But you can't tell them not to communicate and say which pitch is going to be thrown. I mean, so, no.
I think it's so hard for us on this panel, and yourself included as well, Bob, who love baseball so much that I think we kind of forget sometimes that for casual fans who want to be drawn into the game,
right,
if they're watching a game that's pitched by, and Amy brought up the point about Chris Sale, who's so much fun to watch because he gets the ball back. He doesn't shake off the catcher ever. Catcher says fastball, he throws a fastball. It's such a great way to watch a game. Yet on the Red Sox, there's also David Price, who's at the other end of that spectrum where he just seems like he's reading War and Peace before he throws the next pitch. It's unbelievable. So, you know, for casual fans of the game, I can see watching a David Price game and being like, oh, can we go do something else? And I think as, you know, for us who are so into the game, we have to realize there has to be some kind of middle ground there. To me, the best way is what we've all said so far, which is limit the number of times the catcher can go out, that the infielders come in, where they all do that powwow, and they talk about who knows what. I think limiting some of those to a few times a game, I think would be fine.
and putting David Price in the bullpen.
Yeah, he seems to pitch better out of the bullpen, strangely enough, for a $200 million salary guy.
Let's talk to John, calling from Brattleboro. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Afternoon. Thanks. I have a couple of fairly simple suggestions for shortening the game, and I'd like your reaction to the possibility or the feasibility of either of them happening. One of them would be to eliminate the designated hitter, which would put a less proficient hitter back into the game, and you'd probably end up with fewer instances of pitchers injuring themselves because they'd have to know how to run the bases. And at the same time, they're probably going to make an out. And the other one, which I think would be a lot easier and in some ways a lot harder, would be to require the home plate umpire to call balls and strikes per the definition of a strike in the rule book.
Hmm.
Where things stand right now, pitches that are clearly not strikes are called strikes, and in other instances, the opposite. And that, I think, would shorten things up considerably as well. So what do you guys think? Oh, and one last thing. I may have missed the beginning of it when you were talking about people going through all the stuff at home plate. I'm sure all of you remember Mike, the human rain delay Hargrove, who kind of got the whole thing going, and I kind of like it. I think it adds a measure of strategy and drama to the proceedings.
Okay, John, we appreciate your phone call very much. Mitch, you know, there's some people who think there should be an electronic strike zone, that you almost don't need an umpire. What do you think about that?
No, you know, there's got to be the human element to the game, as you know, and it's always that way. You want one of those electronic things when the umpire is making a call against your team. Then it's like, yeah, get the black box in there. No, I think there has to be that interpretation, although I think John makes an excellent point that you can make a good argument for calling the strike the way it's defined. If you look back at games in the 60s, Bob Gibson and guys like that lived off the high strike. It used to be kind of like, you know, almost chest high, and it was still called a strike. That's gone away. That doesn't happen anymore. As far as the designated hitter thing, they have an experimental league called that for that. It's called the National League, and it's just incredibly inferior brand of baseball. You will never, ever, ever get me to say that the designated hitter should go away. That is an innovation that came in 1973. It has made this game so much better. And it's a reason that American League teams are, on average, better than National League teams, because every National League pitcher knows they might be having a tough inning, but whew, here comes that number nine hitter. It's the pitcher. I don't have to worry about him. DH is the way to go.
All right. Kurt, we have a fascinating storyline going on at the beginning of this baseball season, and that involves the California Angels, who have signed a Japanese pitcher, Shohei Ohtani. And his situation is he's a member of the starting rotation. So he's a starting pitcher for the California Angels. He's number four in the rotation. He'll be pitching on Sunday. But he's also a phenomenal hitter. And so as the season starts today, he's going to be the designated hitter. And he's going to be a hitter every day that he doesn't pitch. What do you make of this?
Well, it's something that we haven't seen in baseball, and they refer to him in Japan as Japan's version of Babe Ruth, because, of course, Babe Ruth was a fantastic pitcher before he became the hitter that hit 714 home runs, the Bambino. I think that, I mean, an interesting part was that the Yankees, that was their number one goal, was to sign him in the offseason, and they had put together a whole presentation, and it never happened because Ohtani decided that he did not want to go to a big market team. But that is going to be interesting to watch, to see how that works. A lot of baseball people feel like it's not going to work, that you hamper one by letting him try to do both. But he wasn't going to sign with any team that wasn't going to ensure him that he could try to do both. So it will be interesting. So far, the spring training results have not been good for Ohtani, but it is – it will be very, very interesting to see how this works with him trying to be a pitcher and hit on the off days. I think they will not let him hit every day in between starts. My understanding is maybe the day before or something, he will not be in the lineup.
Amy, another trend that's going on in baseball, and we've talked about previously, is the use of relief pitchers. There is a school of thought that says you should use your best relief pitcher when the game is on the line. If that's the fourth inning, so be it. If it's the ninth inning and we think of a closer, that's okay too. But we're starting to see more teams deciding to use their very best relief pitcher fourth, fifth, sixth inning.
Yeah, and I think it's exciting. I think that baseball gets criticized a lot for falling into old habits and old patterns, and managers who come in and shake things up, people pay attention to that. That's one of the reasons why I'm excited about Cora coming on, and because I have no idea what he's going to do with this pitching staff at the Red Sox, and I can't wait to find out.
Also, a lot of defensive changes happening in baseball, Mitch. The Phillies this season are going to go with this idea that they can change their outfielders during the course of an inning. So if it turns out that they feel that their center fielder is the best defensive player and a batter comes up who always hits the ball to right field, they're going to flip-flop their right fielder and their center fielder. What do you think about that?
You know, it's great if you want to try it. I think that's former Red Sox outfielder Gabe Kapler is actually implementing that with the Phillies now. That seems to me like it's going to be such a small factor. Maybe you'll get one instance where a ball would have been caught by the center fielder who switched positions with the right fielder. That doesn't seem to me like it's going to be a huge impact on the game, but I agree with Amy in that try it. Go for it. If you want to shift around your infielders, your outfielders, you want to try that thing you talked about at the beginning, Bob, where you look more like a summer softball league thing. If you think that's going to work, I say give it a try. It'll make the game look different. It might make it a little bit more exciting. And I don't see any reason why you shouldn't give it a go. I just don't think that switching your outfielders, I mean, all these guys are exceptional athletes or they wouldn't be in the major leagues. And they're all capable of playing outfield positions. There's very few of them. I think they're going to make a huge difference shifting from one position to the other. But we'll see.
Let's talk to Denise, who's calling from St. Albans. Hi, Denise. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind today?
What's on my mind is, what's the big deal? Leave the game alone. If you enjoy baseball, sit back and enjoy it. I don't see that it needs to be short. I enjoy it just the way it is.
All right, Denise, yeah. We appreciate your phone call. You know, the other thing, when we were talking about defensive changes, Kurt, is the idea that going to four outfielders. Now, I mean, if you looked at baseball 20 years ago, you probably didn't see very much defense shifting in the infield going on. Maybe someone would shade a little bit to one side of second base or the other. Now, sometimes a left-handed batter will be up. The third baseman is somewhere in the outfield. The shortstop is over at second. The second baseman is somewhere between second and first. And it's just this crazy situation. And I've been reading about a number of teams who think four outfielders is the way to go. That's the old softball rule.
I think, again, I wouldn't advocate for legislating against this stuff, but I think it's too much tinkering with baseball. It's too much – sometimes a new manager trying to be too creative. I think it's overblown, overdone. I think the shifts are overdone, and I don't like them, to be honest with you. But again, I'm not advocating for legislating against it. And for the previous caller, again, she talked about leave the game the way it is. Again, for as Mitch has said, for all of us, that's fine. But baseball is not attracting as many new young fans, and that's a concern. And
that's the key.
They need to see a game that's moving a little faster, and so. You know, I think decreasing some of these dead spots is still a good thing.
Or can I just jump in here and ask, as a way to get more of those young fans into the game, here's a radical idea in Major League Baseball. How about putting some playoff games on in the afternoon?
Exactly.
Or at least not starting them at 9 o'clock or 8:30
right.
at night. That's why you're losing young fans. They can't stay up and watch these games that go to 2 in the morning. It's
That's a part of it.
Ridiculous. The other thing about some of these outfield changes that I think maybe there's a silver lining, bring back the bunt. Maybe guys will learn how to bunt again so that when you put that third baseman out in the outfield, you say, okay, you've given me a hit down the third baseline. I'm going to drop down a bunt. I'm on first. Thank you very much. That's what I'd like to see come back. Get back to the fundamentals of the game.
Amy, we're also seeing this with pitching rotations. It's probably standard now to have five pitchers in your starting rotation. Everybody gets 4 days of rest. But we're going to see some teams this year, I'm thinking now of Tampa Bay, they're going to go with the old-fashioned four rotation, right? That used to be baseball back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Four pitchers in the rotation, that was it. You didn't worry about pitch counts and all that kind of stuff. And the flip side of that of the Angels, they're actually getting involved in a lot of innovative things this year. They're going to go to a six-person rotation. What kind of impact does this have on the game?
Well, it has an impact on the roster. You know, how many pitchers you have. You can't have as many field position players if you have more people on your pitching roster. So I think that it's a balance, and every team's got to find the right balance. To me, too many pitchers is not a great thing.
And, Mitch, what about the idea of pitch counts and how many pitchers these days have Tommy John surgery? Do you think pitchers are being pampered? Because this didn't happen 30 years ago.
Now, if you were ask a guy like Goose Gossage about that, that's exactly the word he would use, probably with some other words we can't say on the radio. I do think, though, what you talked about before, Bob, with this idea now that we're getting more relievers coming into the game early, and it certainly worked for guys like Andrew Miller and the Cleveland Indians, and I think we're going to see more of that. So I think pitch counts aren't going to be as much of an issue. It's going to be more situational. You know, is this a critical point in the game? Are we up by a run? We want to save that run. Our pitcher looks like he's tiring. Despite the pitch count, they might bring in that reliever for a longer stint. I think that's going to be the new wave of this game.
Well, that's going to have to do it for our program today. Many thanks to our all-star panel, Amy Noyes, Kurt Wright, and Mitch Wortley. Many thanks for being on, and it's opening day.
Thanks for having us, Bob.
Go Red Sox.